All right, today is Sunday, the 4th of February, 2018, and a big Yeshua Tov to my Talmidim in front of me and to all those listening across the wide expanse of the Torah community. I'm all prepared for my shirm in New York, and I hope I can bring covered to the Rebbe's memory, but that's after Purim. The shirm in New York will be different than here. Here I'm going very deep and I want to be very honest. This is what I'm going to talk about today, and I don't know if I'll finish it, is a Matana L'dora, because ultimately when they write the definitive work on the Rav's life 50, 100 years from now, I hope people will have access to my shirm and they can judge whether my interpretation is right, whether I understood the Rav correctly, whether I'm intellectually honest, etc. Now, in relation to last week and that beautiful letter, which really, that last paragraph solves so many problems and catches the Rav, I just want to say that my nephew, Dr. Zev Rothkopf, if you recall, the Rav wrote Hanini Mefager, and we'll come back to that word either later today or tomorrow in a different context. And generally in Hebrew, it means one who's mentally not entirely with it. So if you recall, I stumbled, what did the Rav, how do we say it in English? And my nephew, who was grew up in America and here, I think he meant, in other words, he doesn't mean retarded in the literal sense, but he meant mefager as in the sense of being late or delayed. And what the Rav said to me, mefaker, that I've been late in reacting to the unbelievable knocks on the door, the chase to be cut. Okay, so we spoke in length last week about that letter, and we spoke about the Yahrzeit cheer, and interestingly, I got a student wrote to me in the name of a very famous rabbi, that he'd like to know where he can get his shiurim from the 1950s. I want to say that not much was recorded, unfortunately, in the 1950s. And the recording of the shiurim in the classroom began in 56. There were recordings made. Originally, one recording, a Yahrzeit cheer, I believe it was 44, was recorded on 78 RPM records. It was hard to believe how primitive the world was, but that's the reality. Then I remember we even came up with recordings even before the records that you have to go to the Smithsonian if you want it turned in. You have to pay a fortune, but they have old equipment that can turn it into a contemporary computer program or whatever is the latest trend. But halavai we would have, as I said, the Yahrzeit shirim, and halavai the Rav would have published them. But you'll have to go back to my lectures on the Rav. This was a brisket trait that the Rav suffered from, and we suffer as a result, that he was always afraid to publish in halacha. Rav Chaim published nothing in his lifetime. The whole Chidushei Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi al Rambam, I believe it finally came out in 1935. And the experts say that it was ruined by Rav Velvel, who worked it over, and they got rid of every extra word. And they say sometimes it's so hard to comprehend exactly what the Chaim is saying. But that was brisk. They were just afraid of publishing, and they're not entirely Amita Shel Torah. And each time you learn the sugya, you come up with a new understanding. And as you know, the Rav published in philosophy, and Rakefet feels maybe I'm off base, but in philosophy there's nothing to be afraid of, because you can never be totally right, you can never be totally wrong. This is what makes philosophy, Parshanut HaMikra, homiletics, so interesting, that there's so many different approaches. But in understanding a Gemara to a Briska, ultimately there's only one approach. All right, now I want to go further, and I want to deal with the Rav in the classroom. And I want to deal with the Rav as a Rebbe, and all that went with the concept of the Rav as a teacher. Now, the Rav was a fabulous Rebbe. He was very well organized. He was prepared. even if he didn't have the final concept of the Gemara in his mind, but he knew what he wanted to do, where he wanted to go, and he worked it out in class. He worked it out with the students. He interacted. More than that, he was a lesson in how to teach. He began every Shia Vasav Migazak Letztavach, what did we do last week? And he repeated it. At times he wanted to change something. He thought about it in Boston, the Chabibi Getracht, and then he said, I want to make this change. At times he went further. Then at the end of the Shir, he would say, Vasav Migazak Taint, what did we say today? And he would summarize, and you walked away. You kept notes. It was hard to keep up with him. At times, he's speaking and you want to write. You can't write every word. But as I recall, I wrote in Hebrew. In other words, it's interesting that everyone kept notes in a different language. The Rav was speaking Yiddish, and either you were writing Hebrew or you were writing English. There were not too many in my time who could write Yiddish. In other words, we it's like my grandchildren growing up here, they all speak English. But when it comes to writing or reading, I have some that are on a high level and some that are on an Israeli level that comes nowhere near their ability to write or to read in Hebrew. So there were very few who could write in Yiddish. But I wrote in Hebrew, others wrote in English. Ultimately, I would rework the notes and write them up in Hebrew. And those notes, write them up in better Hebrew, or polished Hebrew, write them up longer, explain it well. And those notes survived, and I never understood why I'm keeping them. Believe me, it was the smartest thing I ever did to keep all the notes, because when they... For instance, Sanhedrin, if you look into the introduction, you'll see that in one perek in Sanhedrin, the only notes that survived are my notes. Other prakim, they had Reb Heschel Shechter, maybe they had from Aaron Lichtenstein, I don't know. But on one perek, whatever happens in life, you know, 70 years ago, 60 years ago, a little bit hard to find exactly where you put it so many years later. And I had it, and it was all photographed and turned into a computer program, and they worked on it in the United States, and I have a copy of all my notes on my computer in the other room. Okay. Now, yes, he was a wonderful teacher. There was, he felt with the students. He always was surrounded by students. And this is something that caught your eye. When he walked through the yeshiva, he never walked alone. When he walked to the subway, remember I told you? He never walked alone. Students badgered him, bothered him. Even when I wasn't a student yet, I saw a crowd walking with Rebbe subway. I joined the crowd. And they were bothering him. They did not shilas and halacha. They were dealing with Stephenson and Eisenhower. And you got a lot of insight. It was the presidential campaign. Remember what I told you? The Rav said that they'll never elect Adlai Stevenson. He's too intellectual. But Eisenhower, who we thought never read a book, and this is open to question, did he ever? They say he started a book in Andrew Jackson, but he never finished it. But Eisenhower was a war hero. He captured the imagination. And then you bothered him with shilas and kids from the Shia, something that the Rav said in Shia. He was always surrounded by students. Now, here I want to tell you a story. I write it up in Washington, beginning on page 119. And this is, I'm not telling ish mi pi ish. My eyes, these ears, saw this, heard this. What happened was, by the... mid-50s, the Rav was the Rav. As I told you, he went through a lot of difficulty in the 30s into the 40s. I'm sure your father and uncle didn't have it so easy in the rabbinate either. And they were Mira. They were from Shanghai. I at least was an American. From my first rabbinate, Habach Nishka Lektanik. I didn't lick honey in my first. The second rabbinate was a different story. So what happened was, we had outsiders coming in, and one in particular, he was rabbi in Inwood, New Jersey, right up the street, about a 10-minute walk, a 12-minute walk from the yeshiva. His name was Rabbi Jacob Radin. He was a 1929 graduate of the Jewish of the seminary, the Jewish Theological Seminary of JTS. Now again, the Rabbanim then, most of the JTS graduates were Shomer Shabbos. It wasn't like what happens later. And he was a Shomer Shabbos, all right. He served in a congregation. There was no machitza, might have been mixed seating. It was called Inwood Jewish Center. I very much doubt if it exists today. In other words, that whole neighborhood has changed. Whatever Yiddishkeit there is moved more north of Inwood into Riverdale. Now, Rabbi Radin used to come to the Sheyurim. And he was on the law committee of the rabbinic assembly of the conservative rabbinic body, and I can still tell you, I remember like it's happened before my eyes. They were having I've lectured on this decades ago, but to be very brief, the rabbinic assembly had a very different policy than what we have in RCA. In RCA, you reach a decision, 1, 2, 3, you put it to a vote. You reach a decision. Tell me, did Yomo turn this on? Is everything on?
Am I...
Excuse me? He did. Okay. Because I see Joseph Krauss is not here. And so we reach a decision, we put it to vote, and that's what the decision is. In the rabbinic assembly, the Committee on Jewish Law, that's what I believe it was called. We were called the Halachic Commission in RCA, and they were called the Committee on Jewish Law. They had many opinions. Any opinion, there were 21 members, Ke'en, Sanhedrin, Katan, and any opinion that had 3 votes is a legitimate opinion, so that you can follow whatever opinion you want. For instance, with Yontif Sheni, one opinion was abolish it, one opinion is, as long as we're in Gullus, keep it. The dominant opinion was that if you have a Yontif Sheni minyan in your shul, don't abolish it, but if it's difficult to make a Yontif Sheni, you don't have to. Fine. The question of Stam Yenim came up. Now, Stam Yenim, what can be non-kosher in wine? You understand? When you're dealing with wine, you're up against a very simple fact of life. There is absolutely nothing non-kosher in wine. All right, the Veda Zara used in the church, the wine used in the church is not going to reach our hands. That's different wine, but you go into the supermarket, you buy Gallo Brothers wine, why can't you drink it? Okay, this was my undoing in my first shtela, when after I made Kiddush, the president of the shul, the Yeshiva College graduate, takes out and says, Rabbi, turn away, this is not for you, a bottle of good, he was a wealthy guy, good French wine, and this is in front of 40 pairs of eyes, 50 pairs of eyes, and I said to him, it's not kosher. And boy, why you got a letter that week, get this moron Rothkopf out of here, he embarrassed the president of the shul, etc., etc. Okay, it's a problem. What should I have done? You can play with it. But this was in public. Remember, people are looking at me. So why can't we drink regular wine? All right, now go and explain to people this is a gezeira that we shouldn't drink with the Gentiles, kiss their daughters, marry, everything happening in America. Today in America, you might want to make a gezeira. We can't drink wine, we can't drink whiskey, we can't drink liquor. But all right, so it's a problem. So the committee was meeting. A member of the committee was Rabbi Radin. So Rabbi Radin, coming to Rabbi Soloveitchik's classes, had become friendly with the Rav. And the Rav liked him. He was a wonderful individual, Rabbi Radin. And he says to Rebbe, look, I need sources. So after class, the Rav calls over his Talmud Mufak, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, and he's sitting there. The Rav is sitting here, and Rabbi Radin and Rabbi Aaron are sitting in front of the Rav, and the Rav sends a shit jingle up to the library, bring me this sefer, bring me that sefer. And the Rav was going through with Rabbi Radin all the sources why we cannot use Stam Yenim even today. And I don't want to go into any more detail, but just to whet your appetite, there's a Tshuva Tarama, very interesting. He was making on certain matters with transportation and other matters of Stam Yainim, and the many of the conservative rabbis wanted to transfer that to a blanket hetta. And the Rav was showing Aaron, go through with him the tshuva and show him what the Ramah really says. I need not tell you, this topic became one of the centerpieces of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's research. I might say it's the master part of Reb Chaim's publicans, and you can go through it in detail if you're really interested in Stam Yainim and you get hold of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's volumes. It'll take you a year's work to work out everything he's published and look at the sources. But you see, this was Rabbi Radin. Now, when it came to a vote, you should know, if my memory's correct, there were three votes that you're not allowed to drink Stam Yainim. Rabbi Radin was one of them. And as a result, that became a valid opinion that if you're a conservative Jew and you don't want to drink Goyish wine, people shouldn't laugh at you. You have three rabbis who say you can't do it. All right, so this gives you a little bit of the relationship between Rabbi Radin and the Rav. Believe it or not, one day after class, and Rabbi Radin was like one of the students. He was, if he got smicha in 1929, so by the late 50s, he was had to be well into his late 40s, right or wrong, and we were kids. How old were we? 17, 18. So we looked up to him. And one day after class, the real learners were gathered around the Rav, were bothering the Rav until he finally can get out of the room and catch his breath. And we're left inside, the real learners. It's not the whole class, but five, six guys and Rabbi Radin. And Rabbi Radin said to us, this is classic. He says, fellas, you know I've studied with Professor Lieberman. I know the seminary. I'm friendly with the leading teachers. You know that I've studied with Rabbi Soloveitchik a number of years already. Would you like to know the difference between them? And we all jump forward. Yes, yes. And his description, he says, Professor Shaul Lieberman comes into class once a week, twice a week, finishes teaching, runs out back to his office, back to his research. You never see him again. He runs out, runs in, no student surrounds him. His life is his research. All right, he has to teach 4 hours a week, has to make a living. Later in the Jerusalem Post, when Liebman started coming to Israel, bought a home here in Rehavia. He died, by the way, on the plane. Are you aware that Professor Liebman died on the Ella plane coming from New York to Tel Aviv on his way to his home where he spent a number of months a year? So in the 70s, the Jerusalem Post interviewed him and they asked him, Professor Liebman, how did you teach at the seminary? And he said, well, everyone knew I'm Orthodox. No question about that. But no institution would give me a real salary for just teaching 4 hours a week and let me devote myself to my research. And you see, that was Professor Lieberman. Whereas Radin says, you never see the Rav alone. You know, I have attended, I'm quoting from page 119 in Washington. You know that I've attended classes in both the seminary and the yeshiva. I've studied with Professor Shaul Lieberman and the Rav. The professor lectures a few times a week. He hurriedly finishes and rushes back to his research. Outside of his formal lectures, he is barely available to the students. On the other hand, the Rav is never alone. He never finished a lecture on time. He always goes overtime. He remains in the classroom afterwards to carry on the Talmudic give and take with the students who cannot part from him. Even when he rises to leave, his disciples surround him and the discussion continues. they do not depart until he reaches his next destination. This scene repeats itself week in and week out in the yeshiva and its vicinity. This is the basic manifest difference between these two leading scholars. And I have to say, this description absolutely, totally, not only accurate, but it captures the heart of the Rav. And I want you to understand me. I'm in no way being negative towards Professor Lieberman. You need people to do research. I can give you another example. Just this morning, I wanted to check something out, so I looked at the Torah Shlema. You're all familiar, Jacob, you're familiar with the Torah Shlema, Rav Menachem Kasha. Did you ever meet Rav Menachem Kasha? No, you're looking at a person who met him. Now, how did you meet him? He didn't talk to anyone. He had no time. He was a Gerer Chassid. He was overwhelmed. He has to finish the Torah Shlema, which he never did. His son, at the end, you never finish. The Otsar Goinim was never finished. The Digdakei Sofrim was never finished. You understand? You undertake a project that is too big for one person. The Tosefta Kapshuta of Professor Lieberman was never finished. No, you need another one like Professor Lieberman to finish. What do you think of a graduate of Bernard Revel? With all due respect to Bernard Revel, they say I'm one of the leading graduates. They made me a Shtiglach Getschgedot. Okay, I'm not bad. But you need a Professor Shaul Lieberman. So I'm not being negative, but the Rav's life was teaching. See, when he came to America, he had a total different understanding. Came to America, looked at Reb Lazer Silva, and we'll get back to Reb Lazer Silva in the Monday class. Reb Lazer Silva, I have what to say about him. I have insight that will help you understand who he was and why he was so unique. But the Rav had different visions. And then he got back into the classroom, and ultimately his whole life became his students. So much so, and I have to say to the credit of the Boston community, that when the Rebbetzin died, Karlsman, the Rebbetzin, was alive. So the summer came, YU breaks up already in June. I don't want to be critical, but I never yet heard of a yeshiva where they stopped learning in June. As far as I know, the traditional break was on Tisha B'Av. No, you try to find students. In my time, I don't know what goes on today, maybe the yeshiva. Tell me, Jacob, there's learning going on July into August in YU, or it's closed down, summer programs. Avi, what do you say? Is there learning? Is the Beis Medrash filled? You could have, in my time, I led a battle that we had to have a Rebbe during the summer, and I have to say, whatever we battled for more Torah, YU accommodated us. Rav Shmuel Feibershevitz, he was the Shanghai crowd too. Sheikh Tzadik Levracha, he was our Rebbe during the summer. And the Rav, when Kolzman, his wife, was alive, so the summer was the summer. The Rav had a summer home in Onset. And he went up to Onset. Rabban Lichtenstein would come up. He was teaching his sons-in-law, teaching his son, teaching his daughters. But when his wife died and the children are all out of the house, the Rav was very, very lonely. He was just in a state of depression. Yitzchak, are you aware of this? And you know who solved the problem? Mo Feuerstein's wife. What was her first name? Shirley? Do I have it right? You don't know. She at Sadeket, these were the Feuersteins from Boston, she saw that the Rav needed students. And they would bring up a group of the top students from New York to study with the Rav on the lawn of Maimonides. On the days it wasn't raining, it was beautiful summer weather, on the lawn of Maimonides, they studied with the Rav. Out of that, knew what piggybacked on that. The rabbis in America were very upset. Why can't we study with the Rav? So at the end of the summer, you had the Yarchei Kala, when the RCA people came up for a week. You studied with the Rav, you would come up, let's say, on Monday, and there was Shirm Monday night, Tuesday morning and afternoon, and Wednesday morning. Or you would come up by Tuesday, the Rabbanim had to be back in the Kehillot for Shabbat, but that was called the Yarche Kala. There were four or five Shegurim, and this all began after the Rebbetzin died, because of the loneliness, the distress of the Rav, the depression, and kol hakavod to the Brookline community where Yitz comes from, that by that time the community had matured and understood what teaching meant to the Rav. So this is one very important point about Rebbe, that he would describe later. He would say, my crazy devotion, right? He would say, no one can understand me, but I must teach. I must pass on the Torah Shebaal Peh. And this became his life. This became the golden, golden moments.
This Rabbi Robin, what was his first name?
Jacob. Jacob. And I spell it, I believe it's R-A-D-U-N, but let me just check. No, R-A-D-I-N.
And he was the rabbi? Yeah,
he was the rabbi in Inwood Jewish Center. I spoke about it. And he was a 1929 graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary. The name of the shul, let me give you the correct name. I did a lot of research for Washington. Even though it's a memoir, I call it a scholarly memoir. No one has yet corrected one fact that I wrote. Inwood Hebrew Congregation. And Inwood was adjacent to Washington Heights. Okay, and it was a conservative temple, but a conservative temple of the traditional style at that time. Okay, now, I want to say something else about the Rav that greatly influenced me as far as teaching, and halavai, everyone should be influenced. It's an open question, this question. You hear it discussed time and again in the literature world. We're all created differently. Who do we teach for? Who do we reach out to? Who do we gear our teaching to? And the Rav already touched this problem in his early philosophic writings. You'll see it already in Ish Halacha. And he quotes, it goes back to his family, goes back to Reb Chaim Volozhin, Nefesh HaChayim, but it's basic brisk understanding of the original brisk. Today, brisk in Israel is a little bit different. I don't want to be critical, but some of the members of the Soloveitchik family themselves are critical of what has happened to brisk, because it's become if it's first class, not business class, and not tourist class, first class for the elite. And that was never brisk. But the Rav raised a very simple question. Who was smarter? Who had a better brain? Who had more intellectual ability? The Vilna Gaon or the shoemaker in Vilna? And it's an interesting question. And the answer is obvious. The Vilna Gaon was certainly smarter than a shoemaker in Vilna. But then when you ask the question, who was holier? Who had more spirituality? Who had more sanctity? And there, everyone can be equal. There's nothing inherently in the Vilna Gaon that makes him holier than a shoemaker. And here you're touching upon the fact that every human being has a soul. To quote the Rav, every mortal can strive to become closer to the Almighty. On this level, the genius possessed no congenital advantage over every other personage. And this was critical to the Rav. His Shiurim were geared for everyone to understand. We mentioned this. Remember with Reb Aaron Cutler, when Reb Aaron died, the students, that was 62. So I remember I was already a Rebbe in the yeshiva. My first year as a Rebbe. And I remember they came into my class. It was terrible news. Reb Aaron Cutley died 70, and a man who had changed the American Torah scene. Simple. And they asked the Rev, and the word went out that the Rev said something very interesting. He said, Reb Aaron teaches the elite. I try to gear my shiurim to the average person in the class. And I laughed because I was one of the few that heard shiurim from both Reb Aaron and, of course, the Rev. And it's absolutely true. Reb Aaron started shiur, you could follow him 10 minutes, 15 minutes, then he went so quickly, he shot so much, at given upgehitzt, he got so enthused with what he was teaching, only a handful understood him. You had to make an appointment to go speak and learning with Reb Yankel Schiff. He was the leading Talmud, a Bronx boy, later marries the Brisker Rav's daughter, lives in Gula. You had to make an appointment. What did he say? I understood him till this point, but here he went, what? The Rav, he would repeat himself, make himself clear. This is very, very important. Malka has said to me, how come you love every student? You know, and I taught her so many thousands of students in the classroom I'm talking about. And not all my students were tzaddikim. Not all my students were tzaddikim. Believe me, I have students sitting in jail at this very moment. Some with long beards and black clothes. They went way to the right afterwards. But I loved every student. Because I told my wife, every student has a soul. And the neck of a Rebbe, the art of a Rebbe, come in, take a seat. The art of a Rebbe has to be to address the soul. And that I got from the Rav, and it's a very, very important concept. I can tell you in modern times, and you're all going to be involved, those of you going into the rabbinate, or those of you stam balam batam, both in America, both in Israel, to reach out to kids who are born from and from homes, that's not an achievement. But to reach out to people who are distant from Yiddishkeit, to go to North Tel Aviv and to bring people into the world of their forefathers, the world of their real existence, that's an achievement. But you have to understand, they all have souls. They all can be reached. There's no one that can't be reached. And that's the Gemara. The Rav always quoted the Gemara. I quoted it so many times over the decades. The Gemara Nida, Daf Lamed Amid Bet, that the Malach teaches you Kol HaTorah, and then gives you a knip, and you forget it all. No, it's a very simple question. Why do you waste the Malach's time? Ribbono Shel Olam, why do you waste the baby's time? If you're going to make him forget it, my high, what have you achieved? What have you gained? But you see, the Rav said, every Jew, there's something in him. His body is ready, his mind is ready, his soul is ready. The Torah was there already. You have to awaken him. And that is the challenge. Now, this explains something else that becomes very important in the Rav's Weltanschauung. And here I have to say, the Torah world goes against us today. You understand? I have to be honest. The guys like Rakefet, we've lost. You heard what happened the other day. I have beautiful colored pictures. I have to thank Yomo. He is an outstanding photographer. And I asked him, make me copies of the best pictures of what happened here once on Thursday night. I need them. There's a reason why. I want to do something with my life. And when I lost, I lost. You have to lose in dignity. And you have to build further and sweep along with the crowd. So I walked in Thursday morning. You know, I'm here every day. So I walked in. I open on the auditorium and I take a look. You can't believe, Chaval, did you see the auditorium was set up like the bells the Rebbe is going to speak? A long table, bleachers. I don't even know what you would call them, bleachers. What other word can we use? they expect to jam in 300 plus students, and outside there's going to be a TV. I saw the TV connection. Now I want to ask you, if it was announced, Harav Dr. Aaron Rakethet, Professor of Rabbinic Literature at Gris Kollel, Talmud Muvhak of the Rav in his golden period, is going to give a shayur on the essence of Rav Soloveitchik's message to the yeshiva university community. You know how many people would be there to hear it? Maybe 25, if I'm lucky. Here, the Mashpir is speaking. My Talmud, the Eish Kodesh Rebbe, right or wrong? The play, mob, jam, singing, jumping, and then he speaks, and then again more singing, and then they come out 1:30 in the morning, chalent galore, Rebbeinu Shelolam. So there was a big machloikis. A guy named Rakefet said, our Rebbeim, Reb Noach Bornstein, and Reb Yeruchim Gerelik saw this. I said within 5 minutes this building would be destroyed. It wouldn't be standing. Rav Avishai David, the principal, the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Shragas, said, wrong, within 1 minute the building wouldn't be standing. So you see, well, all right, we have to live the way we live, the way we brought up, but we have to be realists. Chassidus is one out, wow, on many different levels. So, you see, the Rav, this is where he was, one of the reasons he was upset with the swing to the right. We'll go in, there's more, I'll leave it there. I don't want to do it yet. I want to finish out and have, at the end, a big surprise, but I may not reach it today. But he was upset, the whole concept of everyone looking the same, acting the same, learning the same, this is goes against the grain of the Rav, where the individual becomes so important, where everyone has a soul, and everyone is seeking, and everyone has to go his individualistic way. But as we say last week, we all get a different picture. The framework is the same for everyone. The Vah Hashem Zul Halacha, the man's commands, obedience, respect, surrender. But each one is different. And as the yeshiva world became more Hasidic, the Rav is moving. He's in a different area. And here's where he spells it out. What is there about Hasidus? Hasidus is wonderful. You don't have to make decisions. You go to the Rebbe. What should I do? You go to the Rebbe, Chava Shidduch. Should I go further? This girl for me, not for me. Every question. Where? What school? What yeshiva? What Talmud Torah? What cheder do I send my son to? I have to say, the Lubavitcher Rebbe basically never got involved in Shidduchim, so he was a little bit different. He answered many other questions, but the Shidduchim he didn't get involved with. And I don't think if someone would ask the Rebbe what type of automobile to buy, I don't think the Gaboyim who surrounded the Rebbe would let a question like that through. But other Rebbeim, and then it comes to the literature world where the Rosh Yeshiva are advising the student. You have a sameness where everyone is coming out with the same stempel, the same stamp on him. The Rav had a lot of difficulty with that. And the Rav was right. Look back now. How many of you studied in Mir in Europe? I walked the streets of Mir. I can give you names, Talmud after Talmud. Show me two that came out alike. I'll talk about my own Rebbeim. Look at Reb Chenich Fishman. Look at Reb Noach Bornstein. Look at Reb Yeruchim Gerelik. Look at Reb Lezer Volk, I tell you. Show me two that came out of light. Different, Slabodka. A world of different. Volozhin. All right, there was a downside. Before World War I, you had a very strong percentage of students from the yeshivas that existed. Volozhin tells Slabodka, he had a very, a miyotanikar, to use halachic language, of students who left the path. Here you have a beautiful example from the Boston area, Professor Harry Wolfson, Bucky and Kala Toratula, a genius. Professor Shmuel Atlas, later Hebrew Union College, that's a nephew to Reb Chaim Moshe, that's a nephew to Reb Elchanan Wasserman, his father was Shveili Rav, a gadol shebe gadolim, had a high, Hasidish, generally speaking, from a Hasidish yeshiva, if you remained within, you remained strong, generally. World War II, we saw the same thing, that the Hasidic survivors, a very good percentage retained their Yiddishkeit. The Litvisha, many fell by the wayside. So you see, I'm not being critical, I just want to understand, but the Rav was different. The individuality was very important to him. And he said, I resent very much that certain Rashi Yeshiva and certain teachers want to impose their will upon the boys. And he went into a whole discourse. This was to social workers. I'll give you later the exact source. But he went into a whole discourse that sometimes in life, both decisions are correct. Both ways are correct. And the individual has to make the decision on the basis of his own abilities, his own understanding, his desires. And here the Rav is very powerful. I mean, I can give you a very simple example. The yeshiva, and this was a problem in Israel as well. Today, Baruch Hashem, it's a lot better in Israel. But ultimately in Israel, if someone went to a yeshiva that was more of a Mizrahi yeshiva, no, later he could go to college, go to university. And he could choose a profession in accordance with his own abilities. Those who wanted to be Rabbanim, Bavakasha. Those who wanted to be Machanchim, Bavakasha. And in America too. See, that was YU. That's the greatness of YU. There's so much choice before you. But someone learns in Lakewood, someone learns in Tells, as Tells developed in America, he learns years. What is he going to do? What he can do is be a rabbi, be a machaneich. He's limited in his choice. And the Rav felt that sometimes both choices are correct. You have a right to choose your lifestyle, but this is nothing that can be forced upon you, that a Rosh Yeshiva can guide you. He can only tell you what he did with his life, but he has to encourage you to make your own decision. And this too was part of the Rav, part of his understanding, part of his teaching, part of his relationship with his students. And you never felt second best. If you came to Rebbe and said, I want to be a Rav, I want to do research, I want to learn, I want to get a PhD at Bernard Revel, or if you said to the Rav, I want to be a medical doctor, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be an accountant, but the bottom line, you have to learn Torah, and you have to be great in Torah and understanding. This is the essence of our religious experience. This is Litvish. This is his family tradition. This is Nefesh HaChaim, Reb Chaim Volozhin. This is Reb Chaim Briska. This is the Rav. It's fascinating. We lost out. In other words, in this generation already, Chassidus has conquered the world, and it could be we lost out because we couldn't really thrive with a Litvish message. It is much more difficult. And Hasidus, 500 students dancing, jumping, the Mashpia speaking, and how does he speak? With very little light on. You understand? I have pictures of the Mashpia speaking Thursday night. there's no light, just a little light in back of him, and it's an emotional experience. Darkness. Ah, remember in Bnei Akiva, Camp Moshava, it's Shabbos is leaving, singing Zmira, Tzedash Lishit, no lights around, you're sitting in the darkness. The darkness speaks to you. Your soul comes to the fore. And this is Chassidus. It happened right here. 2-minute walk from where we're sitting. One flight down. Chassidus is conquered. The Rav had a problem with it. The Rav had a real problem. But we'll come back to it. Now I want to come to the heart of today's Shia. Yes, Rabbi Rubin.
Well, like when people would come into Aliyah, they would go to the Rav for a problem. They're really going to the Rav to get approval. And so that means there was an element of, and he, of course, did not give that approval.
No, by the way, Rabbi Morty Green is here right now with his wife, visiting his children, and people met them in Greg's. My Talmud Jack and the Levensteins met them, and they said, Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem, they should only be in health further and have nachat from grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and see a fifth generation. So Morty Green went to the Berber. Remember, we spoke about it last week. When Malka decided we're going in Aliyah, so I wrote Rebbe a letter telling him I'm going in Aliyah and I'm coming to take a birchat preda from him. I'm going to be at his apartment at this time because I was giving shiur in the yeshiva and I generally had to run back to my kehillah, but this day I stayed later to see Rebbe after he finished shiur. So I went to see him, and you know what his word, remember what his first question was? How will you make a living? And that captures the Rav so down to earth, so with it. And believe me, it's a very good question. How will you make a living? So Baruch Hashem, when I met him again, when I saw him in life again, person eye to eye, when the government sent me back in 77 to speak at the RCA convention, this is already after I became an Israeli, after I changed my name legally, after I did the basic training, I was serving in the army, and Rebbe embraces me. He didn't ask me how I make a living. He said, oh, I hear, let me not even repeat what he said. But you see, right down to life, but the message got home. Now, I want to raise a different topic because I'm a Talmud of the Rav, and I want to be totally honest. I don't want people to say, Rakefet is prejudiced, it's his Rebbe. And I want to deal with the question of the initial decades of the Rav's teaching, where he was very sharp, very critical of students, where he could, in the middle of class, if you said something that he didn't agree with, he could jump on you. And these stories are legendary. When the Rav died, it all came out in the Hespedim, including, I told you, Shmuel, Sam is not here, Sam Dratch, I told him his grandfather, the president of the yeshiva, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, in his hesped, he described the Rav, and he was a Talmud of the Rav in the 40s, and he said, it's not the best way for a teacher to teach, but with the Rav it worked. I was a Talmud in the 50s. Now, Yitzchak has a problem understanding what I'm saying. Can anyone tell me why? Because the Rav was two different people. In Boston, he was sweet as sugar. There was very rarely any vinegar. Right or wrong? Maimonides, the classroom. He was building from the ground up against all odds. I'll talk about this in Teaneck in my sermon there. I just changed my ending. My original ending to the sermon was very sharp, and I decided that Gas spiten stuff and tish. When a guest comes, you don't have to spit on the table. So I have a very nice parable.
Who are you speaking to?
And this is Rabbi Przanski's shul. Rabbi Baum's shul is in the afternoon. Rabbi Przanski is in the morning. But I have a very innocuous ending that no one will be upset with. So we'll talk about it. But in Boston, the Rav was a different person. In YU, oh boy, he wanted the best. He wanted to challenge you. He wanted you to amount to something. Now, he was intellectually honest. He could get angry at something you said in class. And you all know the legendary stories. They talk about it in the documentary I brought into the world, The Lonely Man of Faith. He can run after to the greasy spoon. Remember across the street, that little luncheonette. Look for the kid who said that you are not, and apologize. You were right. I was wrong. I have to rework the shear. And we had that a number of times. We had that a number of times where he worked the shear in accordance with the kid whose thought he had dismissed in class. So, of course, as the years marched on, and here I did a lot of research, spoke with family, spoke with friends of the Rav. You see, when you're young, you think you're immortal. That's part of youth. Shir HaShirim. And you know, when you're a genius, you understand, when you have that ability, very hard to come down to the level of the ordinary human being. And you think you're immortal. Yeah, you can do in your mind and your brilliance. And then life moves on. And suddenly you find out, unfortunately, you're not a mortal, you're just mortal. And the Rav had very difficult times. 59, 60, had an operation that statistically, at that time, very little chance that he would survive. All right, you all know that. The wedding of Reb Aaron and Tova was delayed. And the Rav spoke very dramatically at the Yahrzeit Shir that all I asked of the Ribbono Shel Olam, keep me alive, I should be able to go to the wedding of my daughter and my Talmud Reb Aaron. All I asked of him, he says, now I feel better, have bigger requests. But did that change his life? And then lo aleinu, Churban HaBayit, the year of Avelut, his mother dies, his brother dies. You have no idea with the brother what a difficult situation that was, because his wife was critically ill. And you all know the Rav went to visit his wife every day in the hospital. And when he went to he shaved. He didn't stop shaving during the Avelut. He put on regular shoes. Can anyone tell me why? Pikuach nefesh. Not to upset his wife, because the first thing his wife would look at him, he's growing a beard, he had a Van Dyke, but here, shaved, put on regular shoes, she would look down, imagine if she saw sneakers, what he went through. And last week, we were looking for the word is very simple, I'll use the word as the Rav matured, his entire relationship with his students changed. You can use the word matured or mellowed. As the Rav mellowed, his entire relationship with the students changed. And you see that in the documentary. I hope you've all seen the documentary, the Rav. If not, we can show it here one day, but Mo can do miracles. We can arrange with them, whatever, but let Yomo know and we can decide. Make it open if wives can come. I don't know in the morning what the story is. Maybe the Midrashiyah would join with us, whatever. So in the documentary, you have their interview, one of Talmidim of the Rav, and he describes the 70s that Chaim Soloveitchik, my classmate, Reb Chaim, has come back from Israel. I give him credit. He left Israel to go back and sleep with his father, take care of his father. The Rav's health was challenged at that time, lo aleinu, and Chaim turns to Reb Heschel Schechter, I think it is, and says to him, Heschel, how can it be that my father has changed so? A kid just said Narishkeit in class, and instead of chopping his head off, the Rav just, no, listen, said, you know, didn't respond. So you see, there was a whole process here. But the question remains, who is the Rav? Why was he like that? Can we understand the Rav? Okay, I can tell you a story that happened right here in this building, although it's in a part of the building that was remodeled. Originally, the Kollel classes the rooms we toured in don't exist. It's where the whole, where Sherry sits, that whole part of the building originally was classrooms. It was a different structure. And the Kollel taught in one of the classrooms. There were many times I was teaching, and Nechama Leibowitz was teaching right next door to me in BMT, with wonderful moments in time. So one time there was a Rabbi Yishmael Kohn, and I'm taking you back in the history of Yeshiva now, Ish Kohn. Ish Kohn, his father was a Rav in South America. And he was a Sephardic kid, a South American, who his father sent to the yeshiva to become a Talmud Chacham. And he was one of the good students in the yeshiva. I had to be about 5 years older than I am, 5, 6 years older. And the Rav was teaching Masechet Shabbat that year. And there's anyone from that era knows the story. The Rav was discussing a zipper. Can you pull a zipper up on Shabbat? Nu, what's the Shaila? Jacob, what's the Shaila? Bona. What are you doing with the zipper? You're creating, you're closing, you're bona. And the Ish Kohn shouts out, Rebbe, in South America, the pants only have buttons. And the class was hysterical. In other words, he said, in South America, they're worried about using a zipper on Shabbos, so all the pants are built with buttons. Do you remember Yitz pants with buttons? No one remembers it today. Today, everything is zipper. But that was Ish. So he came in Aliyah at a very early age, and he worked for the Misrad HaDavar. When I came in Aliyah in 69, he was in charge of Geirut in the Misrad HaDavar. And occasionally saw each other, and then one time he asked me, this has to be in the 80s, because I was teaching in that room, and he asked me, what's going on with YU here? I said, come sit in a few classes. Aaron is teaching, I'm teaching, you'll see what's going on. So he came to Gris, he came to my class, and after class he asked permission to speak, and he cried, and he said, why didn't the Rav have this relationship with his students? You follow? That he cried and he said, we lost some of our top minds to JTS. They were frightened away from the yeshiva. No, give me an example who later writes books about it. No? Chaim Potok, of course. Chaim Potok, Rabbi Dr. Sharpstein, is the Rav. Rabbi Yeruchim Gorelick is in there. And he was frightened stiff, and he winds up in JTS, and the rest is history, as they say. So here there's a very interesting question. Why was the Rav so sharp? Why was he like this? Okay, interesting. We can analyze. This is a very interesting volume. If you haven't read it, you should. If you have any interest in the history of Yeshiva, Orthodoxy Awakens, the Belkin Era, and Yeshiva University. You'll read the introduction, you'll see that yours truly played a big role in getting this volume published. It's by Victor Geller. Who was Victor Geller? Victor Geller was someone who already was in the yeshiva in the late 30s. When he entered the high school, Hungarian, parents came to America, maybe in the 20s, I don't remember. He writes about it. And a very bright individual, was in the yeshiva in the late 30s, knew Dr. Belkin when Dr. Belkin was still a Rebbe in the yeshiva, serves in World War II, and later comes back, marries. His wife was a New York Giants fan, one of the few people I ever met, a Jew who is a New York Giants fan, but it's okay, the Giants fielded more Jewish players than any other baseball team, the Yankees and even the Dodgers. And
he was called to come for the Yankees wouldn't do that.
Kala Kavon, so you hear Eidet Nemana from a Bresla that they let in Hebrew school kids for nothing, unlike the Yankee Stadium, Kala Kavod. So, and he worked for Yeshiva a number of times, Community Service Division. He was a very bright individual, Vic Geller. Tremendous insight. he could cut through problems very quickly and get to the root of it. He would have made a terrific Hasidic Rebbe, actually. That's the truth. He had that terrific insight. So in this volume, Orthodoxy Reawakens, he tries to understand why the Rav was the way he was. And I want to give you a little bit of his insight. I think we can sign on the dotted line. This is Vic's description beginning on page 262. His classroom was brisk revisited. It was a contemporary setting for the Torah of his father, Reb Moshe, and his grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker. He invoked their methods and their standards. The thorough preparation and total attention was expected from his students. His standards of scholarship brook no compromise. Unfortunate was the Talmud who was not ready for the shiur. The student who dared to offer less than his very best was a candidate for his Rebbe's shock rebuke. He could expect a withering cascade of comments questioning his fitness to be in the class. Such outbursts, which mellowed with the passing years, were the Rav's way of insisting that there would be no compromise with rigorous scholarship. Paradoxically, his flashes of temper also contained an invitation to us Talmidim to challenge him, while daunting the student who dared to do so pleased his teacher. Now, does that bring anything back to mind? You see, when a Rebbe is giving a shiur, his ultimate goal is to make the student alert, awake, even able to challenge the Rebbe. Litvashur word, Torah is an ongoing achievement, an ongoing Mesorah. Reb Aaron Cutler, remember the story I told you? Reb Aaron Cutler, 1954, comes to take over for Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, at least partially as the titular head of Yeshiva Beitz Chaim, visits Hebron, gives a shiur in Hebron, who's sitting with his feet on the table? No? Reb Beryl Schwartzman? And Reb Aaron barks at him, "Das heißt Kavet HaTera?" And what does Beryl bark back? "Eb der Sheshiva gekent Lerenin, I would give Kavet." And he shoots Reb Aaron Cutler down with a Rambam that destroys the shiur. How does Reb Aaron react? Takes him for a son-in-law. You follow? It's exactly Vic Geller's description here is right on. If you challenge the Rav, on one hand, you ran the risk he'd cut you down to size. On the other hand, he appreciated the challenge. This is a student who's with it. It's a student who's learning. You heard about what happened to Rothkopf? They found it on a tape. I played it here in the Kollel, in this room. Remember in Sanhedrin? What did the Rav call me? A Reform Rabbi. Was bist du? A Reform Rabbi? And the whole class is laughing. I'm mad at the class. Instead of supporting me, at least talk up. I have a source. I'm talking. But that the Rav called me a Reform Rabbi is the greatest compliment. It shows Martin Hebrew, who mitchashev
be. Did he give an answer?
The Rav went on. He didn't accept what I was trying to do. But beside that, but this is very sensitive. On more than one occasion, the young man had to endure a hard dressing down for his incorrect approach to a particular topic, only to hear his Rebbe announce in class on the following day that further investigation proved that the young man's position was correct. And that's the story with the greasy spoon. And that story repeats itself. It didn't just happen once. It happened this year and a few years later. It's like the stories of Yeruchim Gerelik with the boy and the girl in the subway Saturday night. As a mieskai kachnishten mein ganze Leben gesehen, that happened with my class. People swore to me it happened 2 years earlier. Then there was a story 2 years later. You understand that this is the personality, this is the reality, this is the Rav. Now, Vic raises another problem, and we will get to his solution. He's very insightful here. You see, Talmidim and a Rebbe, ultimately, if this is your Rebbe Mufak, whatever, by the way, the Rebbe Mufak, you know what a Rebbe Mufak means? You're looking to the Rambam, Hilchot Talmud Torah, Rav Chochmato. The Rav once gave a tremendous Yahrzeit Shir in the early 70s. What is a Rebbe Mufak? And there is no Talmud Chacham who learned most of what he knows with one Rebbe. Impossible. Impossible. I learned in yeshiva, I had many Rebbeim, and my Rebbe Muvak was the Rav. All right, I learned with the Rav many years. But Ribbono Shel Olam, thank God, I know infinitely more today than I knew leaving the yeshiva in 61. And I did it all on my own. I studied this morning, a typical morning, by 15, I already started learning. I've started every day. I've finished Shas a number of times. So you are Baruch Hashem. Ah, so what does it mean? Rebbe Mufak, Rav Chachmato. So the Rav said, the key to learning. Someone taught you how to learn, how to understand, how to be Machadesh, how to have insight, how to put together Shas and Paiskim. The key to learning. That's the Rebbe Mufak. Later you fill it in. From that key you open a small door, a bigger door. Ultimately you open the doors to the Ulam. But that's the Rebbe Mufak. When you have a Rebbe Mufak, you love your Rebbe. See, let's talk Chassidus. How do Chassidim relate to the Rebbe? Remember I said something about Rebbeim and the whole concept of Das Teira, and it stems from the Hasidic concept. And you remember how many people Chassidim wrote in that I'm partially right. But in the Hasidic world, the Rebbe is your father. It's a different feeling. There's love. How does a child feel to a father? How do grandchildren feel to a father? I got news for you. Grandchildren love a father more than children. I'm seeing it in my own life. Absolutely seeing it in my own life. B'nei bonim harayim kabonim. You know, marma chazal, halachic implications. But much more than that. Because children have the Freudian attitude. This is part of life. Freud is not entirely wrong. I heard from the Rav. I told you the word I heard from the Rav. Three people had tremendous ideas: Machiavelli, Marx, and Freud, and each one thought their idea explains civilization. And Machiavelli, you understand power, individual wants power. Marx, money, and Freud, sex, father-child relationship, mother-child, parent-children. Oh, what Freud develops, this, and the Rav said, they're all wrong, but they're all a third right. And the Rav quoted Maimon Chazal, he's to show, power, you can quote many Maimon Chazal to prove that each one is partially right. But grandchildren already, they are one generation removed, and they're this pure, pure love. It's a different feeling. So you see, students love their Rebbe. If a Rebbe feels students love him, he's not going to be that sharp. He's not going to be that demanding. He's not going to be that rebuking, that reprimanding. No, why didn't the Rav feel this love? And here I hold that Vic Geller is absolutely, totally insightful and correct. Notwithstanding his fearsome reputation as a demanding taskmaster, his many talmidim came to love their teacher. While this affection was not overtly evident, it was deep and abiding. The teacher knew, of course, that his students feared the bite of his criticism. What he did not realize was the profound affection his students felt toward him. He was so intent on eliciting first-rate work from his talmidim that he thought that his demands placed an emotional barrier between him and his students. No such barrier existed. Though he could not accept the classic reference of Talmud for Rebbe, he was unable to allow himself the joy of believing that they also loved him as a person. The Talmidim understood that if their teacher's mind seemed stern and rigorously unrelenting, the man was in fact warm, even gentle, and forgiving. And I have to say, I consider that paragraph very, very insightful. The Rav in his prime, the 40s, the 50s, slightly into the 60s, he couldn't understand the love his students had for him. There was an emotional barrier. He was demanding. He was the genius. He was the anacle of Reb Chaim. We all understood that. But the Rav couldn't comprehend the love that his students had for him. And we're going to come back to this. Why couldn't he? Where does it change in the late 60s into the 70s? Vic here is very insightful. And you see, what's more amazing, that the Rav on a personal level is a kind, sensitive, humble individual. And people, this comes across in the documentary as well, there was no shtick with the Rav. No third person. You all know what I've spoken about so many times, that when boys started going to Kerem B'Yavne, that was the first yeshiva that YU fellas went to in the late 50s, early 60s. There was nothing yet. The whole concept of BMT, exporting Torah, Dafka to Anglos, only comes about after the Six-Day War. But when boys started coming back from Kerem B'Yavne, they have the classic story where right after class, we're talking and learning with the Rav, and my chavruta, Jerry Blau, you know him as Rav Yosef Blau, says to the Rav, the Rav said, and the Rav shouts at him, "What Rav do you mean? Who do you mean?" And he says, "Rebbe, I mean you, so say you." He couldn't handle that third person. He answered the telephone. He opened the door to his house. See, people are amazed. There were other rabbis. You'll take Rav Yitzchak Kuttner. Okay, I don't want to go further. The mere mention of the Chaim Berlin Rosh Yeshiva conveys the image of a Hasidic Rebbe. Whoever heard of a Hasidic Rebbe opening the door? When a Chassid comes into the Rebbe, you never sit. When someone would come into the Lubavitcher, they praise the seventh Rebbe, that sometimes people who are not chassidim came in, he knew to tell them to sit down. A chassid will never sit. There's an entire different way of acting. Kavod hatorah. The Rav was not part of all that. He, very humble, to a certain degree, unassuming. And here I'll tell you a story that I know about, and I'll read to you the story that Vic Geller tells, and you get a good feeling of the Rav, of this complexity and this contradiction between the classroom to the reality outside of the classroom. And this story was told to me by a Rosh Yeshiva in YU, but he asked me not to use his name. And the story is very simple. This was a Hungarian home. After Shabbos, the father would learn with his sons, and the women were kicked into the kitchen. Fine. No, you're growing up in America. This particular girl was very bright. She's going to Barnard. And she was already offended. Why can't she learn with her father? Very different than the Rav, who had his daughters along with his son and his sons-in-law. Well, this troubled her, and she started to ask questions about religion. It all begins with feminism, modern world, 1970s. And then there was a family wedding. And her brother, who teaches at NYU, told her when she finishes classes at Barnard to take the train uptown to meet him in First Hall at NYU, and he'll drive her to the wedding. So, she comes uptown, waiting for her brother in the lobby. If you could envision First Hall, there are benches near the elevators. And out of the elevator, there is this Rosh Yeshiva who finished shiur, coming down with the Rav who just finished shiur. And he introduces the Rav. He says, "Rebbe, this is my sister." And he says to the sister, "This is my Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik." Fine. And now they reach the door of First Hall. New Steve, how would you react? You're reaching the door. Your Rabbi X, Rosh Yeshiva X, your sister, the Rav. No? Rosh Yeshiva X, Aryeh, and the sister stand aside. The Rav, right, should go first. And the Rav's, no. Ladies first. And he insists that the sister go first. P.S. All her problems with Torah Tashim Tamima disappeared in that moment. It's a beautiful story. That's the Rav. The same Rav who in the classroom, Zorak Morib Talmidam, that's the Rav. On the personal level, outside of the classroom, I'm now reading Vikela, Rav Soloveitchik was an old world gentleman. This was revealed to me in a personal experience. The son of a yeshiva administrator was getting married. The Rav was to be the Masada Kedushin at the wedding. Since we were coming from Queens, Vic and Hanya, the Geller family, lived in Forest Hills. The father of the groom asked me to pick the Rav up at LaGuardia Airport and to bring him to the wedding at a Midtown hotel. Naturally, my wife Hanya and I were honored to be asked. When Hanya and I met him, the Rav wanted to sit in back of the car rather than displace my wife. It was only when Hanya insisted that he took his place in the front. Upon our arrival at the airport, I pulled up to let my passengers off while I went to park the car. Rav Soloveitchik quickly got out and hurried to open the door for Hanya. He helped her out of the car and accompanied her into the hotel. Now, mind you, while all this is happening, Vic Geller has gone to park the car, right? When I reached the wedding hall, I found the Rav and Hanya waiting for me. When he saw me, he said, "Thank you for bringing me. Now that you are here, my duties as an escort are finished." Hanya later explained what he meant. She told me when they got to the hall, Rav Soloveitchik was almost immediately surrounded by rabbinic guests. Hanya tried to leave them, but the Rav wouldn't hear of it. He told her that until I arrived, he felt his duty not to leave her alone. Gallantry never had finer auspices. And that's a classic example of the Rav. Boston, one of the most moving stories I came up with in my research was after the Rav's wife died. You all know that the Rav was a human being, and at times there were tremendous contradictions. From Ish Halacha, if you're familiar with Ish Halacha, until his wife died, the Rav basically never went to a cemetery. Why didn't he go to a cemetery? His father's grave. The Briska never went to a cemetery. The Vilna Gaon never went to a cemetery. The Rav writes about it in Ish Halacha. In Wertheim's work in Chassidus, he shows that there were Hasidic Rebbeim as well who didn't go to a cemetery. If you're familiar with Hasidus, so you can understand it very easily. A Chassid has to be happy. Avodat Hashem, Gilu Lefanov, Radab, but Gilu Lefanov, Simcha, Alachayim. But the Rav was already a different story. Kedushat Achayim, life, Mishenev, a person dies, he becomes Pater from Mitzvah. Cemetery is a sad place. People there can't learn Torah. This is the Vilna Gaon, where this is where in Ish Halacha, where he, Reb Chaim, when Reb Chaim had a deal with death, he was very depressed. Only when he opened up Mishnayot of Taharat, and there were dinim of Ohalot and Tumat Tameit and Tumat Mishkav V'chulu and Paraduma. So Reb Chaim saw that even in death there is halacha. That mitigated the depression, made him feel better. It's a classic. This is the Rav Ish Halacha. Didn't visit the grave. Nebuch, when his wife died, he went to the grave every Friday in Boston. People asked him, Rebbe, what are you doing? It's against your teachings, your writings. And the Rebbe answered, Was kann ich tun? What can I do? I'm a human being. I must. Now that he visited his wife's grave, one time Rabbi Finkelstein picks him up. George was then the man who picked him up when he flew into LaGuardia. And the Rav told him he wants to visit his parents' graves, Detour, the cemetery between Queens and Brooklyn. And George will describe to you, if you see him, ask him, describe to me the tears, the Rav pouring out, standing. It was his father, his mother, his brother, the graves right there, the Chelkat Brisk. So, one time in Boston, on a Friday, during Chodesh Elul, people are coming to the cemetery, people have a minute, Chodesh Elul, even Jews that aren't that frum, but no tradition, they go to the cemetery to visit the graves of their forebears and ask them to be intercede with the Ribbono Shel Olam, Zomim Oisbet Na Gute Yar, and family is there, and they come over to the Rav, and they ask him, could he help them? And they don't know Hebrew to help make the prayer. And the Rav goes with them and makes a kelmole and does what has to be done. And they want to give the Rav a $20 bill. And the Rav says, no, it's not necessary. And the Rav says, no, and he walks on and the car waiting for him, the driver, and the driver looks at these people, and they're coming out, and he goes over, and he tells them, this we only find out later. Do you know who that was? Who made the kill me? P.S. Sunday morning, a nice check was left at Maimonides by a family of Reformed Jews for whom the Rav had helped at the cemetery. So can you picture that sight, the simplicity, the humility, the man, the personality, and such a difference between the classroom to Boston to the Rav out in the world. How do we explain it? you watch. Next week I'll come. Vic has a certain theory here that may have a lot of truth to it. And that theory affects my own life I'm sitting here because of it, but we'll come to that next week. Yes, Yitzchak?
Well, you actually alluded to this, that when he was in New York, it was like a jungle.
Yeah, no, I understand. He was relaxed in Boston, true. One second.
In other words, he was really like the
Stadtwald.
He didn't have a pastoral role, even in Mariah, he gave it a confession. In Boston, with Maimonides' parents and people, he felt a pastoral role.
No, and Boston was his. He took from the ground. The Rav said that he'll get into Olam Haba, and he said Maimonides. That's his greatest ticket to Olam Haba. And we would like him to say, I'll get into Olam Haba because I raised Talmidim who taught Torah all over the world. Look what his Talmidim did. America, Canada, Israel.
Okay, he brought up in 75 years, the school has Orthodox boys and girls who are in all areas of life.
No. Maimonides says Yesh Mayayin, what he was up against in Boston, what it was like in the 30s. You know, it's not the...
This was the time when there wasn't day schools. There was just Ramaz in New York.
Ramaz in New York. Baltimore had a day school. That was it.
One of the alumni also married a Korean girl.
Listen, the alumni of Lakewood and Meard, we don't have to talk, so it doesn't, that's not
a...
It was a whole story.
He was a professor at Harvard.
Right. One of these people who know it all and are bigger than God. But okay. All right, let me reiterate. First of all, I want to thank you very much for coming. Tomorrow's lecture will finish out this lecture and supplement and complement it. And we're heading into a very interesting theory, and we'll take it a little bit further. And then we have a final concluding little mini lecture, which really captures the Rav and shows you the heart of the man and how he was different, how he was so unique. And some of you can understand why I'm sitting here. When you're exposed to this greatness, this individual, it certainly implants a great deal upon you. And this is my Rebbe Mufak in the full sense of the word. So let me reiterate. What did we do today? All right, we spoke mainly today was the Rav as a teacher, as a Rebbe in the classroom. Again, I could spend 22 years again, as I did in the years of 1980 on, giving you Shtiklach Teirah from the Rav Sheurim. You'd get to see the brisk approach, supplemented by modernity. He was Kulo Torah, tremendous insight. Makpid, his mitzvah, the way he did the with Shaifa, we spoke about it, with someone watching the seconds on a watch. Tzadik Yisod Olam, all he could to enhance what he received from his father and from the Tatum, the Naman, from Zayda, Reb Chaim. The Rav was the Rav. One of my best stories, which I'll tell at YU in New York, if time allows, when I'm speaking on Pesach, on the Haggadah, the Rav on the teaching of Torah through the Haggadah. But one story which captures the Rav, not many people know the story. I know it because Bishat Maisa, members of his family, told me what had happened. And it's very simple. It has to be someone from Boston can probably figure out when it happened. But it was a consul, one of the people who worked in the consul, or the consul to Boston from the Israeli government, was a frum Jew, an observant Jew. And he was close to the Rav, came to his shayrim, probably came Saturday night in Boston, Sunday morning. And Pesach, he asked the Rav, Rebbe, can I come inside for the Tzaita Seder, that's a mere Zayna Faganigin, it'll be a pleasure for me to see the way you run the Seder. Now, mind you, this guy's coming to the second Seder of the Rav. Most Israelis in America, what do they observe? One day. So he's coming as a spectator. He's in the bleachers. So, he's in heaven. He's enjoying the Rav, the Torah. I mean, what a moment in time. And then they reach the meal. No, he's going to eat with them, but he doesn't have to be yotze anything tonight. And the Rav sees how little matz. He said, Nein, I hold for you is also yantiv tonight. The Rav shita, nothing to do with your mind. It has to do where your feet are. Rakefit in America is one day. Rakefit in New York or Johannesburg. Or I've been second day yantiv in Melbourne. 2 days. Like everyone else. Right or wrong. Reb Chaim, the Chacham Tzvi. Okay, so the poor guy has to start eating matzah with the shear of the Rav. Then they get to the Mara, Shem Yerachem. Then they get to the Korach. The poor guy had stomach trouble for days afterwards, but catches the Rav, the Hakpada on mitzvot, on Sheurim, Tzidkut. And this contradiction, the man, ladies first, doesn't leave Hanya Gela to the Rav returns. Zarak b'tol midav. We'll understand it tomorrow, be as ratan otein liyav koach. A few things, 1 second, this is for Yitzchak. Does anyone want, by the way, Yitzchak was right, the letter of the Rav to the Rebbetzin to Miriam Shiloh appears in Community Covenant and Commitment, but there's no comment, and the comment we made on the end paragraph I hold to be crucial. If anyone wants a copy of the letter in the Rav's handwriting, you're welcome to it. One second, Herb. This is classic. A number of mechanchim went to Rav Steinman. A number of mechanchim went to Rav Steinman and asked him to outlaw the children reading Sifrei Metach, mystery books, Sifrei Metach, spy books. Kids like to read, and Rav Steinman said, What is that Sifrei Metach? It's like the, you know, when you go, Rabbi, what bracha should I make on a Rolls Royce? So the rabbi says, a Rolls Royce. You go to a reform rabbi, says, what's a bracha? So Rav Steinman said, what's Sifrei Metach? And the Mechanchim told them stories that the authors see in their minds make up. And Rav Steinman asked them, what do you want the children to read? And the Mechanchim answered, we want stories about tzaddikim. And Rav Steinman said, and isn't this something that the writers make up in their minds? Beautiful, beautiful thought. Okay, New York Times, Vatican, eager for Chinese ties, ask underground bishops to step aside. If you know what's going on in China and the Catholic Church, and now the Roman Catholic Church is getting rid of the, in other words, giving in to the Chinese demands to try to make proper ties, and they'll put in different priests. New York Times, this is fascinating, dangerously low on water, Cape Town now faces day zero. Could you imagine a community where one day a week, you know that in Israel after the Yom Kippur War, gas became so scarce, so it was a different world then, one day a week you were not allowed to drive your car. And you had to choose the day. It was on your car with a sticker. We chose Shabbos. Shabbos was, if any normal person chose Shabbos, but many people chose different days during the week. Yes, Yitzchak.
There's more to that story than what the paper writes. The truth is, using Israeli technology, the countries north of South Africa all have water.
Water.
But South Africa, being anti-Israel, refused to accept Israeli systems.
Right.
And because of that, Magia.
And it desalting the nation, they evidently, that's what you're talking about, because it says there they're not up to date on desalitizing the water.
Yeah, but they would never acknowledge that.
David, all right, but all right, have I finished everything? All right, I want to thank everyone for coming, and until we meet again in health and happiness tomorrow morning, Das Vidanya.
Amen.